Okay, so I want to thank for being invited here to give this talk. I want to talk about engineered dissipation or dissipation with cold atoms. And the main point is this, that in quantum optics we know a lot about decoherence, dissipation, and all of these things, spontaneous emission and so on. But the point is now to combine these things with many-body systems. And there's sort of, I mean, there's this old Western that some of you might know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, in physics, we have no ugly. We only have difficult things. But the good thing, the good part is that we can actually engineer dissipation, and this is something that many of us find very exciting. As you know, Ignacio gave a colloquium last week that was only devoted to essentially engineering dissipation. And this applies both to quantum information and also condensed matter physics. I will say a few things about this from, so to say, our angle at the end. Then there's a bad part that, of course, dissipation means decoherence in an optical lattice we have heating. And as a matter of fact, since Matthias was actually the one who motivated us looking at heating in optical lattices, I would like to start out first with this part over here, which is the bad one, decoherence. Trying to understand it, this is non-equilibrium dynamics of heating in optical lattices. And then, of course, from the many-body point of view, I know that many of you are sort of coming from the numerical side, there's this problem of, it's very difficult that we have a non-equilibrium problem here. We have to solve, for example, many-body master equations. I will argue that this describes things of this sort here. So techniques for solving these things are, you know, quite rare. And so I will make a few comments about that. Okay, so let me start out with the first example, which is sort of a really hands-on example where people like myself feel they are kind of the useful theorist that can also work together with the experiment. And as I mentioned before, the motivation for essentially looking at these things like heating and decoherence due to emission of photons in an optical lattice is mainly motivated by the fact that if you look at experiments, symbolic here, Manuel Bloch, and if you look at you know, really many-body theory, high power, like what Matthias represents here, then at the moment the whole field is at a stage where we do a quantitative comparison of theory with experiment. And so fine details come up, and I mean decoherence, like these things, are one part and we have to understand it. And actually it's quite interesting to understand these things and find out what they mean. So the question is this, to talk about the interplay between decoherence and many-body and dissipation and spontaneous emission in particular. Then you will see at the end that I will argue now that what we will derive are master equations. We will derive such equations, write them down for the many-body case, and then ask how to solve these things, for example, in 1D with time-dependent DMRG, combining it with quantum trajectories, and maybe also doing some sort of time-dependent mean field, but now for density matrix. There's a lot of interesting questions here. I should maybe start out by telling you a few words about master equations in quantum optics. So I have kind of a mini tutorial now of just a few slides that comes, you know, in a few slides to quantum trajectories. So for the maybe more condensed matter audience in this context, a note on master equations in quantum optics, okay? Sort of symbolic for this whole thing, the example that you should have in mind in the following, this is the most simple one, it's just a two-level system. You know, we have an optical frequency, we are putting in a laser, we can take the electron from up here, there's emission of a photon. So we can see that this is a problem where we are driving, you know, the system really hard and many photons are emitted. I mean, the lifetime of an atom is something like maybe 10 nanoseconds, so you know, over a period of time of an experiment, for example, many photons can be emitted. And so what you have is a driven system. Driven is very important here. We not only have an open system, we have a driven open system where sort of energy is flowing through the whole system. And we can argue, in this case of quantum optics, that because we have a lifetime gamma, which is much less than the optical frequency, we are in the weak coupling regime, and therefore a master equation is valid. So I will now derive this thing very briefly, and then I will write down the corresponding many-body part and explain what the corresponding physics is.
Master equation output itself is quite general. I mean, it doesn't have to have anything to do with
photon
and so on, so I'm not quite at
can we, point. You're asking this too early.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so. Okay, here's sort of the generic quantum optical model in the most simple form. We have a Hamiltonian, you know, there's a system, a bath, and some interaction. And the bath is a harmonic oscillator bath. Of course, in quantum optics, you have radiation fields. This could be photons, but could also be phonons maybe at one point. But the essential point is this, that in writing down this bath, we are only interested in the frequencies of the bath that are around the photons that will be emitted, because this is this weak coupling limit. So this is the reason that allows us to do essentially a rotating wave approximation. And you should read these kind of interactions here such that, I mean, it's kind of trivial even here, you know, C is the operator that takes, in the case of the atom from the excited state to the ground state, and as a consequence, a photon will be emitted. At the end, we call this the quantum jump operator that shows up in the master equation. And of course, here's the emission conjugate term that corresponds to the absorption, and then the electron would climb up. So the important point is that due to the fact that gamma is much less than this optical frequency, we have a small parameter that justifies these rotating wave approximation ideas, and therefore also the so-called Markovian or white noise limit. Because you might ask, you know, I'm writing down here a certain bandwidth of my path. So this is sort of plotted here. You know, what we do in the theory, we have an optical frequency, then all of the dynamics of the real system timescale, spontaneous emission, Rabi frequencies happen in the frequency scale, which is a narrow band around this thing. And then we have introduced another parameter, which is this theta over here, which is a cutoff, which we assume to be much less than the optical frequency, but also much broader than all of the system dynamics. So you can see that what comes in here, sort of a hierarchy of different timescales that comes in, and we are just using that. So the optical frequency for us usually is very important. So having said this thing, we can do also this so-called Markov approximation, where you can replace this kappa of omega, this frequency dependence here, by a constant. In condensed matter, when you're not able to do rotating wave, you're not allowed to do all of these things, but we are very lucky in this case. So based on this, we are able to make progress, and we are essentially able to solve this problem. And let me just give you the outcome when you actually sit down and solve this equation. Turns out that you can solve it exactly, and it's a very intuitive interpretation. So if I have a two-level system that emits many, many photons, what you will get as a function of time will be, it will be a huge superposition state where the atom has emitted no photon, one photon, and this one emitted at the time t1, but we don't know, you know, what this time t1 is, so there will be a sum, a superposition over all of these photon emission times, plus all the way down here. And then you have, you know, this whole sequence of emissions over here that you have. And there's, you know, correlated with this thing a certain part of the system wave function here. And you can see that the system wave function over here knows that, you know, a photon has been emitted at time t1, t2, all the way up to the time tn. Now, what's the time evolution that we have over here for this system? The time evolution that we have here for the system would correspond to the following. You know, if you actually did a measurement, and if the measurement sort of, you know, would pick out exactly this part of the superposition state over here, when you do a photon counting experiment, you would, for example, in an experiment like this, detect the first photon at time t1, the second at t2, and then the last one at time tn, and then none anymore. So you can ask, you know, given a sequence like this, you know, what's the corresponding wave function? And the answer that comes out here is that whenever there's emission of a photon, you know, over here, the time evolution of my system wave function undergoes what we call a quantum jump. It's sort of obvious in the case of the atom, because it simply means that the atom makes a transition, the operator C, back to the ground state. Emitting a photon means it goes to the ground state. And in between, it's characterized by some non-effective, some non-Hermitian effective Hamiltonian that we have over here. So. And if I trace over all of this path, I mean, then the result will be the master equation. So rho is now the density matrix of my system. And I've traced over it, and you can see that this has a so-called Lindblad form that I will afterwards refer to. And now you can see that if you look at the Lindblad master equation, look at this jump operator that appears over here. This is the interpretation. So this whole thing is valid under the assumptions that I quoted before, namely that we have this hierarchy of timescales, which is nothing else but stating the Markov approximation. But for spontaneous emission, this is an extremely good approximation because the optical frequencies are so large. Okay, so what does it now mean in practice? In practice, this provides also a very useful tool, what we have over here, to do simulations. Because, you know, instead of, for example, solving the master equation here directly, if I got a system of dimension n, you know, the master equation would be n squared. This is large, so you have to do a lot of work. But of course, in our context, in particular, if you have only weak decoherence, like what we want to have in an optical lattice, you can try to actually simulate something like this, and then you do exactly a simulation, which is sort of written down here, that you simulate a fictitious experiment where you sort of throw coins, you know, when a photon is emitted, and there are certain rules that you can derive from that, you know, it's given by the norm of this expression over here, actually down here. And then when you do that, for example, you would actually simulate in an experiment on the computer for your entertainment, you know, where you would see, well, a photon is emitted here, 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 here. But then, of course, this theory will tell you what the underlying wave function is. This is the system evolution, you know, that will actually be associated with the corresponding photon counts. So this becomes a useful tool for solving a density matrix equation, because you can simulate your counting statistics and sort of simulate many runs like you would do in an experiment. And if you do not read your photodetector, it's equivalent to saying that you trace over the vacuum modes of the radiation field. It simply means that you can run quantum trajectories here in the way that I mentioned that before. That's particularly useful if you want to do many-body system, because in 1D, you might be doing something like DMRG, time-dependent DMRG, and then, you know, you can easily combine it with that, and this is a nice way of simulating that. And, you know, this is, I guess, what a lot of people do in this context. So this was sort of a primer in the subject of quantum trajectories, combined then possibly with DMRG. And now let me go to the physics, back to this thing. And talk about this interplay between decoherence and many body. So in the very old days, where some of us were young, and I think that this was one of Ignacio's first papers that he wrote with us, and in general, I think it was a time where his publication list was maybe single digit or something like that. It's really unbelievable. You know, we looked at ion trap laser cooling and stuff like that. And we wrote this paper on laser cooling of trapped ions in the standing light wave. Yeah? Sort of it's now easy when we talk about heating in an optical lattice to translate some of these things from these early days, but there's of course new effects here, and at the end we really want to go many-body. But so let's first of all talk very qualitatively about heating in an optical lattice per single particle. So how do we get an optical lattice? We get an optical lattice by having counterpropagating laser fields. We detune, for example, red side here from the excited state, could also hear from the blue side. Just assuming that a single excited state, in reality, of course, there will be many. But we're just making a two-level assumption here to simplify these things. And now you can see that when we write down, for example, our Bloch bands, you know, there would be a lowest Bloch band down here, first Bloch band up here, and then all of us write down happily our Hubbard models, then we would simply take this expansion in terms of these Vanier functions, put in the hopping between these sites, and of course also the interaction, and then it would be, you know, the single or multi-band Hubbard model. And I mean, there have been a very large number of talks about, you know, corresponding engineering of these things and quantum phases and so on. So what we want to do now is ask what the effect is of spontaneous emission. And the first thing that you can realize is this, that if you got an optical lattice over here, of course, we have a lattice spacing of lambda over 2. And in the case of a red detuning, the dark shift always goes down. So this means that these points where the atoms tend to sit, for example, in the lowest bands, are a point of the highest intensity. So this means that actually, you know, to sit at the points of maximum light intensity, so they will actually scatter light. They not only provide the stark shift goes like, you know, 1 over delta, I didn't write it down here, and the spontaneous emission goes down like 1 over delta squared. But you can see there will be processes of the type, like the one over here, where a photon is absorbed and you go back to the same one, but there's also ones where you sort of, you know, go to what we call the red or blue sideband here. This has, you know, there would be a photon emitted that's a little bit shorter than the one over here. So we can redistribute population between the bands. We can also see right away that in these systems here, we usually have a small parameter, like what we have in the ion traps, namely that the localization of this wave function relative to this lambda over 2 is very small. And this gives you what we call the Lamb-Picke parameter, which is nothing else but k, wave factor of the light, 2 pi divided by lambda a naught, much less than 1. So, you know, we might have a localization here of something like 30 nanometers, but this lambda over 2, then of course, maybe something like, 250 nanometers, maybe a factor of 10, you know, but then of course, there's also some factors of 2 pi creeping up here. Okay, but you can see now what the main difference is relative to the blue case. In the blue case, of course, you would not have a process going back, because in the blue case, you sit at the point where the light intensity is zero. So at least the lowest order Lamb-Picke, you know, this thing has a finite extent. So this wave function overlaps a little bit with the light intensity, but very little. So the lowest order is Lamb-Picke parameter. This process of going back down to the same one is missing. But of course, the process of going to the sideband is actually the same. So at that point, you can see right away, you know, what we have in terms of this heating. Red detuning gives rise to more spontaneous emission events in the deep lattice, and processes returning atoms to the lowest bands are strongly suppressed for the blue detuning. Okay, so having said these things, let me now sort of sit down and write down the master equation for n bosons. For fermions, it will be the same. I will make some comments about fermions afterwards. But sort of let me write these things down to have an equation that at the end we really want to solve or sort of reduce to something simple, like sort of a Hubbard-like model, but now at the end for density matrix equation. Now, I argued before that, you know, if I talk about, you know, two-level systems, and here the Markov approximation, master equation, we believe all of these things, that's an excellent approximation. We should not worry about these things. The question is, what's the many-body master equation? Now, quite often we can write the master equations in the following form, that I take this Lindblad term, and I have this term that before we had a C, rho C dagger, that we call the recycling term, and then we can write the rest as sort of a non-Hermitian effective Hamiltonian. So let me write down this non-Hermitian effective Hamiltonian and this recycling term in this case here, sort of splitting up the physics between the different parts. So first of all, trivially, of course, if I'm writing down here some field theory, I would have a part which is the optical lattice part. You know, H naught, this is a single atom physics, psi diagram psi over here, kinetic energy, optical potential, you would expand in Bloch bands, you get your Hubbard model out, and all of these kind of things. So this is the obvious. A little bit less obvious is the part when you talk about including the radiation field. So let me first of all pick out the parts that all of you know quite well from the case of single atom physics. If I give you a single atom in the excited state, there will be spontaneous emission. Of course, we want to see these things reflected in our equation because we have here, you know, a term which is psi dagger psi. This is the density. We have adiabatically eliminated the excited state. And you can see that this term over here, in this Hermitian Hamiltonian, as part of the master equation, describes essentially this optical pumping process where you go up and go down. And you can see the optical pumping process depends on the density, the local density in the ground state, and it's multiplied exactly by this, you know, gamma omega of x, and this is your Rabi frequency depending on whether you're red or blue detuned, it will be now shifted relative to each other, which is the optical pumping rate. So this is simple single particle optical pumping, exactly what we had in the picture on the last slide. Now, of course, there will be more complicated things coming in when you talk about many-body problems. The first one is that, of course, there will be superradiance, and there will be a term like the one over here, you know, psi dagger psi dagger psi psi. You know, there will be emission of bosons, for example, of atoms that are close together, lambda over 2, which is stronger. We'll soon discuss this function f over here, and of course, there will also be dipole-dipole interaction, which is the first line. So there's interactions, and there's, in addition to the single particle picture, dissipation. You can see that this thing here is normally ordered. So this was this part here in the Hamiltonian that I just explained. Let me now sort of go over here to this part, which is what we normally call the recycling part, and write it down for this case. So again, for us in quantum optics, it's pretty obvious, I mean, how to read this equation. This is the equation where we had the quantum jump operator on one side, and then we had the, you know, quantum jump operator psi dagger on the other side. You can see that this is a density. What's sort of interesting is that this density, rho density here for the ground state, is multiplied here by the function f that we have. So how does this function look? This function is plotted over here, and this function is a function that's essentially localized, this thing decays, on a scale which is given by lambda, so the wavelengths of the light. So this means that if I sort of rephrase what I have over here, this is the process, you know, up here, this would be the loss term in the excited state when you go down. And this part over here is the recycling, when the ground state sort of catches this electron after the optical pumping process. But actually, you know, if you did a fictitious experiment, you would be able to see what Greiner, what Markus Greiner does. Namely, if you look through a microscope, the emission of a photon essentially localizes the atom to something which is the wavelength of the light. And this is exactly this function that you can see up here. So spontaneous emission, if I observe it, you know, it has the resolution essentially given by this function over here. So this means that when we do our integration of our master equation, every spontaneous emission will sort of reduce the atom. And if you don't observe, you know, that the photon was emitted, you don't know where it is. But essentially, this will be the incoherent parts in the master equation that determine this heating and localization of the particle. Okay. So in this sense, spontaneous emission localizes the particle to a wavelength. Okay. There's another part in the whole story, which is the one I've sort of talked about, you know, the large distance physics over here. If you go very close in, there will be collisions, okay? And then really the dirty atomic physics starts. So this dirty atomic physics is essentially that you have to talk about collisions. For example, in the ground state, it's pretty clear what it means, you know? the ground state, if I talk about an optical lattice and I have two particles over here, they will repel each other. And all of us know, I mean, how to calculate this thing. This will be related to the scattering length. You would have particles, and I plot here just the effective potential of the relative coordinate of two of these atoms sitting in the harmonic oscillator potential, which is sitting over here. And we are sort of talking about scattering of particles with this energy, you know, due to these short-range interactions. So in principle, this is something which is quite obvious how to calculate that. You know, we would calculate the scattering length and then put it in and then do the rest of our theory. Now, actually, the way that you should think what's going on here is very similar in the following sense. You know, a long time ago, Zsora Shlapnikov wrote a paper about what he called optical Feshbach resonances. And what he had in mind, he sort of plotted over here that there was a laser, you know, which is somehow tuned. There's some vibrational states that are going on up here in this excited state, and it will somehow tune close. But by tuning across this resonance, of course, there would be a Stark shift. This Stark shift essentially would give rise to a scattering length, which now would be, of course, intensity dependence. There will be g of x over here to indicate that. But of course, in all of these processes, we have light-induced collisions up here. There can be really bad loss going on. And now you really have to do your molecular homework and calculate all of these losses. And as a consequence, there will be two-body loss due to light-induced collisions, and we would add something like that. But the point is, sort of the way that I've argued, it's already clear that all of these things are like an imaginary and real and imaginary part of a scattering length that can now be intensity dependent. So this is the collisional part that we have to add in order to account for the short-range physics in this whole thing. So putting all of that together, I think it's now obvious what kind of equation we have to write down to understand heating in an optical lattice. It's sort of, you know, a standard equation by our, you know, Hubbard model, multiband Hubbard model, HGP is in front. And then I'm just writing down, you know, Lindblad terms here projected on all of these different sides and bands and so on and so on. So it's fairly obvious, but it's also not very illuminating. We'll discuss the physics now in one moment. Let me just remind you that if I take the example of a red lattice, red attuned lattice, and I make a single band approximation, which is actually bad, but let's do it for the moment, then the corresponding master equation up here would reduce to something that we immediately recognize. You know, it is simply that we have a sum here of some rates. This is the optical bumping rate due to the on the red tuning side, and this would be a density-density correlation that we have here. You know, it's sort of really, you have a defacing of the system. And this thing, of course, if we got the Bose-Einstein condensate, will destroy the visibility because this sort of, you know, localizes. This is the point where you really localize your wave packet in the spontaneous emission, whereas before the wave function was very broad. Let me also mention that, you know, we have actually played around a little bit, and I'm not sure how good this approximation actually is on it or not with this mean field Gutzwiller. I mean, all of you, you know, we heard yesterday a talk that talked about mean field Gutzwiller from many bands. You write down your product ansatz, you have your mean field Hamiltonians. What you learn from this is that why not try to solve mass equations of this type, in particular in the case that you got many bands, with a very similar ansatz. They write this rho as a product of rho i's. And essentially, you trace out by this product ansatz over the other sides, and then you get the nonlinear master equation out here, where now the quantum jump operators sort of, you know, contain some of the many-body physics. And you self-consistently solve this nonlinear master equation over here in order to understand, for example, the heating in an optical lattice. So this thing would sort of reduce to the standard Gutzwiller stuff that we always do if I leave out heating, but it would now include the dynamics. This is really time-dependent Gutzwiller stuff over here. So we have a lot of results for that, but I will not really show them. So coming back to this picture now, for example, then you can do a look at the total light scattering rate and make, of course, one observation over here. But sort of, you know, go back to the single particle picture. It was this thing here, red, we had a lot of spontaneous emission. Blue, we had very little. You know, you can plot now, for example, the light scattering rate. You can actually see that if U over J is very small, you're in the superfluid regime, there's a certain probability that two bosonic atoms are on the same side, and there will even be a bosonic enhancement factor which is coming in here. So this is bosonic enhancement of spontaneous emission, something that Maciek had actually described a long time ago. But in terms of the energy increase, for example, what it means is now the following. Now, it is very clear, even in this picture, and one can make this much more rigorous, that you know, if you ask what's the energy increase of my system, the heating in my optical lattice due to these processes only redistribute these things within the lower band, which is very essentially no energy change. The real energy change only comes from interband couplings. And this goes therefore essentially with the recoil energy. This is the Lamb-Dicke parameter. The heating rate is essentially something like this bumping rate multiplied by the recoil, and it turns out to be independent if you are here or over here. So at that point you might conclude red and blue heating is the same. Actually, it's not true, as we'll see in a minute, because we don't have thermalization, as we will argue. So, to sort of summarize this thing, in the case of a superfluid, you can see that the effect of spontaneous emission would be that the photon emission essentially localizes your atomic wave packet within the wavelengths, and if you don't observe it, you just don't know where this localization is. This is essentially what the master equation describes. And it's also very clear that if I do the mod insulator, then it would have an optical bumping here. The mod insulator would not care about this thing because the particle is already localized. So at that point, you say right away that spontaneous emission localization, but the effect on different many body states, of course, will be quite different. But the important point now is, however, the following one. What these processes can do is that they can redistribute atoms to the first excited band. Now, as we heard in the talk again yesterday, they talked about, you know, trying to lower this excited band down to overlap with the U, that you got terms here where you got processes where you can sort of hop by collisions to the excited band. Under normal circumstances, you know, once you have an excitation over here, this thing will never thermalize, where this thing goes also back to the ground state, but sort of all of the other particles get maybe a higher energy. So the assumption of thermalization in these systems is simply normally not true. And that's, I guess, a very important message. Well, at that point, you can actually do now DMRG and all of these things, and you get sort of, you know, what's quite kind of obvious, but I said it before, a superfluid, for example, would be extremely sensitive in terms of long-range order to this kind of spontaneous emission. And indeed, if you plot here as a function of time, this is the decay, essentially, of the off-diagonal correlation function over here, you know, that sort of measures what the how the long-range order will go down. You can see that the long-range order sort of goes down as a function of time. The mod insulator would be rather insensitive. And then you can also study much more complicated things like, you know, the effect of sort of collisions when you got an atom over here, which is now maybe the first excited band. It will sort of, you know, propagate over here. It will interact with all of these particles. I mean, how does it thermalize relative to these two? And so on. And I mean, again, we have done a lot of calculations along these lines that maybe should not really enter here in much detail. Okay, so let me just conclude here with one comment in this part here, which is on fermions. I think fermions are quite interesting, and fermions sort of offer one obvious new thing that could have quite some consequences here, which is Pauli blocking. So think of a following experiment, like in the case of alkaline earth atoms, you could really do that. Let me assume that I prepare an atom in an excited state, and for the moment, let me assume that the lifetime is actually so long that I can talk about the individual trap levels even in the excited states. Then it's very clear that if the trap here and down here would be the same, you know, you would sort of simply decay down here, and you would have dominant decay this channel, then this would be the different motion side bands, as we would call it. But it's also obvious that, you know, if an atom already sits down here, the dominant line will be Fermi blocked. So if you translate these kind of scenarios now to the case of atoms hopping on an optical lattice, you can see that if you already got a spin up here and the spin down is sort of optically bumped, part of these processes will be blocked by Pauli blocking. And there's a rather complicated interplay. And actually, Andrew Daly is studying some of these things right now at the moment. Yeah. Okay, so this was sort of a part on this heating in optical lattices. And did I answer your question or not? Okay, good. Okay, let me now move on and talk about something that's you know, very close, as I said, to our heart, which is engineered quantum dissipation.
Heart, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, I know very little about this. You talked about equations, but is my understanding correct that each atom has its own dissipative bar?
Well, in this case, if I got an atom and one is over here and here and the distance is larger than the wavelengths, essentially they're independent. You know, if they are less than the wavelengths together, they will be dependent, and this is what we call super radiance and all of these things. So in this sense, this is a correlated path, and actually this, you know, part was contained, for example, in things that, you know, are these things here, you know, okay. And you can see that it comes with this function f that we have over here. And this function f, you know, is localized relative to the wavelength. So it's not an uncorrelated path. It depends on the distance. You know, larger than the wavelength is uncorrelated, otherwise clearly not. Yeah? But it's part of the master equation dynamics. Yeah?
conservative part of it, which is type 9, what we have the type 9.
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm.
But also a question about this part. So, all of his analysis have been done with an implicit assumption, at least as far as I understand, that the optical potential for the ground state and for the excited state is identical.
No. The reason why I say no is this thing, that you can see that I've written down this master equation in the form where the excited state has been eliminated. You know, there is a detuning down here, and we assume that the detuning is much larger than whatever this little shift is of the excited state. Okay, so this assumption, we write down the adiabatically eliminated, you know, excited state master equation, and therefore we have these deltas down here. Okay, so we don't make this assumption.
You have terms also of the same order, which would basically correspond to the kind of, you know, atoms being kicked when they're in excited state. Because, I mean, the potential for the excited state.
I mean, the kicking, you know, the momentum transfer, I mean, there's an X dependence over here. I mean, you know, if you include these things, you would get sort of a denominator with some delta over here, and then you would include the optical potential in this delta in the denominator down there. And you can expand, it would be a higher order term. So I argue that for these very large tunings that we are here, we don't have to, I mean, the excited state potential does not really matter because our detuning is so much larger than that.
On the excited state, which would be opposite then from.
Yeah, but the dipole force is up there, and there's this function G that I'm not discussing here relative to this F and so on. So, no, but the single, what do you mean by single particle dipole force? Okay, I think we should talk about it afterwards. I think that these things are included by just this population, the higher bands. This is this momentum kick that you talk about. Okay. So let me now move on to this sort of more futuristic things of this engineered quantum dissipation that I find actually quite interesting. And here's sort of a general summary of some of these things. You know, what we normally do, particularly in this program on optical lattices, we think about Hamiltonians, we think about optical lattices and get all of these phases. We talk about quantum computing, you think about time evolution over here. But all of these things is coherent dynamics and has to do sort of strongly correlated states, equilibrium, condensed matter physics, and then here dynamics. And then we have our tools here on this cold atom side. So open many-body system essentially now means this. You know, on a very formal basis, you would say an open system essentially means that we got the system coupled to some environment. And if you don't read this environment, this is what we call open loop dynamics. You can write, of course, your most general positive, completely positive maps that maps the initial density operator to your final one, and it's given by this, you know, so-called Krauss operators EK here, and this is a non-unitary time evolution. So all of these things is entanglement with environment. Normally, when you talk about decoherence in the system, this is exactly what we do. And of course, if you make the assumption, the additional one, that this is a Markovian evolution, that means that there's a generator for this thing here. Not all of these things can be written as a, you know, e to the L generator, then in this limit, so-called Markovian limits, if there's an infinitesimal generator, this thing reduces exactly to this Lindblad master equation that we had here before. And in terms of the physics, of course, we know what the restriction and the validity is. The assumption is always that the correlation time of your reservoir has to be sufficiently short for these things to be valid. So this is a physical requirement when you at the end do, for example, reservoir engineering, what has to come in. So validity, well, let's see, below, actually we already talked about these things here. So in quantum control theory, this is what we call open loop versus closed loop. In closed loop, we would read out some measurement and then sort of act back and look at the corresponding time evolution. Now, the kind of things, and Ignacio elaborated on this last week to some class now, can we actually engineer maps in such a way that you go to a specific state that we want to be a pure state, and for example, to be a desired state and of interest. And of course, it's particularly interesting if you talk about many-body systems. And on the level of the master equation, you would simply say, if I integrate my master equation, normally I go to some mixed steady state, but I want to engineer my couplings to the environment, my quantum jump operators, in such a way that I get the desired pure state. So now dissipation, sort of this pumping, becomes a tool. And of course, all of us know the typical, not the typical example, but I emphasize that single particle physics, that when we do optical bumping in atomic physics, we might have some initial mixed state down here. But if you apply a laser light over here, if you wait long enough, everything will be over here. So this is an example of this purification process. We can see that, you know, in terms of the laser excitation, this is what we call a dark state, and therefore, you know, we also have used sort of the notion of a dark state in this context over here. So the interesting part is now to re-ask some of these questions in the context of many-body systems. Again, of course, you would write down your general master equation Lindblad operators, but if you think in terms of optical lattices, we have now lattices, and there would be sort of operators that, well, it depends now on what kind of resources you want to assume. You know, I mean, are these local resources? You assume that dissipation is only local, or is there also maybe something global available that you can do in terms of engineering? Global would be, say, if you embed this thing in some high Q cavity, and then it docks with specific cavity modes, and then it becomes non-local. So these can be quasi-local Lindblad operators normally, but you know, if one is clever, it could even be more. And you can see that the question then sort of reduces that you have these jump operators, and you would like to find dark states. You know, you would like to find a set of operators so that this is a unique solution for that. And if there's a Hamiltonian, it should also be a corresponding eigenstate. And then you have to ask the question, given a set of jump operators, how do I engineer now the corresponding reservoir coupling in order to realize that? There's some discussions about uniqueness, and I mean, there's papers down here that discuss it, and as I said, Ignacio mentioned some of these things also last week. Uniqueness, for example, is discussed in his first paper, and this quantum reservoir engineering, we had a whole bunch of papers, but for example, this is one that talks about these kind of ideas, so we'll mention that afterwards. Okay, so there's sort of two kinds of application. One goes towards quantum information. And if I start down here, I mean, Ignacio explained this great paper together with Frank on this distributive quantum computing, where the idea or the question to be asked is this: can I engineer this dissipation such that the pure state that comes out here would correspond to something that we normally think about when we do a quantum logic network model? And so we have analyzed these things. No, we've been thinking much more sort of on the condensed matter side in terms of cored atoms, where we talk about, say, spins or qubits in an optical lattice. Think of, I mean, I've drawn here something like a toric coat Hamiltonian, think of that. And then ask if you can do cooling in these kind of spin systems. And you know, what's kind of interesting is this, that both Ignacio and myself are now involved in an experiment. On the Innsbruck side, we convinced the experimentalists to try to do something like that, that we, what we actually want to do with cored atoms in the lattice, to do with trapped ions, because they have all of these engineering tools where, for example, they simply took one of these Kitaev blackheads over here, mapped it to, for example, four ions, declared one of the ions an auxiliary ion, an ancilla, that can undergo optical bumping. And actually, this combination, together with all of these entangling operations you can do in the case of the trapped ions, allows you to engineer, for example, a complete master equation that allows you to do exactly what I mentioned before. And at the very end, I will just flash up a result that illustrates some of these things. I was sort of motivated by exactly, can we do cooling on a Kitaev blackhead? And also Eugene Polsik has done an experiment. Ignacio had explained these kind of things. They took two atomic ensembles, and by sending light through at the end, they did some optical bumping into an EPR type state. Okay, so let me move on here. And sort of, you know, from the condensed matter side, you might look at these things in the following way. When you talk about thermodynamic equilibrium, what you plot is you want to do phase diagrams. You know, you have maybe some parameters G, and you know, if you think about quantum phase transitions, your Hamiltonian might have some critical coupling, and there may be, you know, different orders here, a quantum critical regime. It's a function of temperature here. In our case, that we do this non-equilibrium stuff, and I really emphasize we are driving the system. So this is a driven dissipative system, what we're doing. If you assume that it can be described in this Markovian way over here, you can see that a phase diagram here is a completely different meaning. First of all, it's not entirely clear that there is a steady state of the whole system. But there, if there is one, you can sort of identify here in these parameters. There will be certain parameters that will be in this Hamiltonian, where, for example, this Lindblad term starts to compete with the Hamiltonian here and vice versa. So there can be certain phase transitions over here, but sort of in a non-equilibrium sense, it's a function of these different control parameters. So some people like to call this a dynamical quantum phase transition. So temperature doesn't appear. So the question is, I mean, how to calculate actually such phase diagrams, and this means solving these master equations, which at the moment for many body systems, we don't really have so many tools. Now, I wanted to talk about two examples here. One is this dissipative D-wave pairing. So I have a few slides. If you want to see that, I mean, ask me afterwards. So we sort of identify the quantum jump operators that, for example, you don't have any Hamiltonian, so that any initial mixed state is sort of, you know, contracted down, that at the very end you get some BCS state. BCS does not have the meaning of a mean field. It is sort of, say, the desired state if we want to engineer. But we get dissipative D-wave pairing. So dissipation induces pairing, and excitations above this pairing would now correspond to something that, you know, is not energy. We don't have any, you know, Coulomb blockades, or sort of gaps. We have now imaginary parts where these things sort of damps back down to the original state. Okay, and then an example that we discussed actually some time ago, but I maybe mentioned this thing here briefly because it has to do with this engineering of Bath, and Trey Porto is actually thinking about doing experiments along these lines. So maybe it's worthwhile to think a little bit about it, and I just give the basic ideas here. So it's the idea of a driven PEC. It's much simpler here. PEC is kind of trivial. Pairing is much more exotic, and then this dynamical phase transition. So let me just outline briefly what the physics is with my hands without going in any details. Okay, so we have our optical lattice here, and these ideas go back to some time now. We have our optical lattice here. And of course, atoms are hopping around happily, and we can also go in and shine with the laser and lift these atoms up to the first excited band, where they hop even faster. So there would be a Raman process over here, and different hopping upstairs and downstairs. And so similar to what Misha Lukin and also Eugene Dembler have done, we thought about embedding such an optical lattice into a Bose-Einstein condensate, and now we want to take as the bath in our reservoir sort of the excitations on top of this PEC. This is our Bogoliubov reservoir. And the process then sort of, you know, the dissipative process then looks for us like spontaneous emission. You know, this is it's a quantum optics version, I feel at home. You might excite an atom up here to the excited band, and it might tunnel over. But now by a collision with one of these background atoms, you know, it can sort of emit here a phonon or a Bogoliubov particle and sort of, you know, excite this thing over here. And it might actually cool your reservoir if you want to do these things or not. So it becomes very much like a quantum optics problem, assuming, of course, you know, again, and that's very important, you know, that I mentioned before that we have here in our reservoir, in the quantum optics context, a photon. We have an optical frequency here, and the expansion parameter has to do with the gamma being much less than the optical frequency. You know, this made this thing in an optical context essentially exact. But now in a completely different energy scale, you have here something very similar. You have a first excited Bloch band, and if the decay rates that one talks about here, you know, are smaller than the separation, and this is something that you can tune by scattering, essentially tuning the scattering length with your BEC, it becomes, again, you know, that you can describe this problem, the lowest order, with the master equation. Of course, it would be very nice to do some of these calculations really as it is here, namely to do really a BEC, and then here together, for example, you know, with including the optical lattice, would be a two species calculation than here. Okay, so here's sort of the reason why this becomes spontaneous emission. You know, if you look at this process where you go from the excited band here down to the lower band, and you plot here the Bogoliubov spectrum, there's a phonon-like spectrum down here, there's a particle-like spectrum, and it actually turns out that if you write down your BEC reservoir, it would be just harmonic oscillators. And the collision term, if you do the rotating wave approximation, you know, this thing would not be valid within the lowest band, but there actually we can argue that these processes are very small, you would sort of get exactly a two-level system coupled to the vacuum modes of the radiation field, in this case actually would be phonons. Not phonons, but these particle-like excitations up there. There would be a structure effect and all of that. We can put in numbers, and these numbers sort of, you know, look quite okay. But of course, it's very clear the master equation is a much more severe approximation in this case than relative to what it was before. So we went on to this context and designed some ideas to sort of do laser cooling within the Bloch band and all of that, but I don't want to talk about it, but let me just mention these quantum phase transitions here, because this sort of indicates this kind of engineering that we've thought about in this context. So that's a paper that we wrote 2 years ago. Well, if you come from the atomic physics side and you see a lambda system, then a lambda system always means that there's, you know, three electronic states. We have our laser excitations with our omega, but we have, of course, you know, that we have optical bumping into the dark state, which is we got the symmetric and anti-symmetric combination. Only one of them couples to the light, and the dark state is decoupled, so it's very clear this is just the optical bumping picture. Everything will be bumped over into the state. But what we can do with an optical lattice is actually something which is indicated here, namely to do this not for internal levels, but now in space. We have now here the optical lattice that we're plotting down here, and we have here, of course, the usual tunneling which is going on. But now the kind of processes we would like to switch on are this, that we sort of do a lambda system here. This is another, you know, spin-dependent lattice that we introduce over here, that we have an excitation over here with a Raman process, one over here, and then, you know, this phonon can be emitted here or here. We have a lambda system which is exactly the situation up here, so there will be dark states. So up here we sort of argued that, you know, when I put on this laser, at the very end I pump everything into the dark state, which is the symmetric superposition of the two ground states. And actually if you do the same thing over here, what will happen is this, that you sort of, this Vanier function, this one, there will be a symmetric and an anti-symmetric combination. What this dissipation does, it sort of, you know, pumps it into the symmetric combination, and you might look at this as sort of being a phase locking. If this was a condensate, and this was a condensate over here, this would be a dissipative phase locking where the phases of the two condensates are locked together. But now you can see that if I have another one here and another one here, you know, if this was a little condensate, it would now be dissipatively locked to this one, this one, this one. So it sort of looks like an array of dissipative Josephine junctions here. And in quantum optics, this is simply a spatial chain of such lambda systems. So it doesn't come much as a surprise that if you, you know, write down master equation that incorporates this kind of physics here, that the steady state will actually be a Bose-Einstein condensate. At least it will be an ideal one if there's no interactions. You can see that here's atoms on two sides, and you know, this optical bumping essentially means that the bright state is phase locked into the plus state. This is exactly this dissipative bumping process which is going on here. So we are pumping into a symmetric state. Well, now you put all of these things here together. You can see we have here a master equation, and we write down jump operators. And actually this jump operator, the essential part is this one, this AI minus AJ. This is the part that sort of takes exactly what we had over here. You know, that takes the one, which is the wrong linear combination, puts it up, and then it bumps it down until it falls into the one, which is the right one, the symmetric. And it simply turns out that, you know, that this part, that the Bose-Einstein condensate is just an eigenstate of this part of the jump operator. Over here you can write down whatever you want. So at that point, what we have is a master equation where we have engineered dissipation. And what this dissipation wants to do with, it would like to drive the system into an ideal Bose-Einstein condensate, into this pure state with long-range order. On the other hand, we have here a Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian, the kinetic energy, will be very happy with this PC over here. But of course, the interaction that we have here will try to destroy that. So as a consequence, what the system will do is that if my dissipation dominates, it will be a BEC. If I start to put on my interactions, like the U over here, the consequence of this thing will be that it will destroy the BEC, there will be depletion. And if you make this very, very large, then there will be this phase transition, which turns out to be actually a phase transition to a thermal state that you can calculate in this model, provided that you do this kind of Kunzwiller-Dark mean failure theory that we did before. Okay, so at that point you can sit down and you can do non-equilibrium phase diagrams. And I don't want to explain it now really in much detail. You can see that this is sort of the hopping down here. And as I have argued before, the interaction plays sort of the role of the temperature. You know, if my interaction is zero, this thing down here is for all, you know, very happily condensed and is an ideal Bose-Einstein condensate. If I start to switch on my interaction, it is still condensed, but at one point there's a phase transition to something like a thermal-like state. And what we found actually quite fascinating is that at least in this mean field Kunzwiller prediction, you also get unstable regimes here. So there's certain regimes in these non-equilibrium phase diagrams that are unstable. So this is...
Mm-hmm. Are there conditions on this turning on of people assuming it to be adiabatic, sudden, or it doesn't matter?
We are looking here, I mean, we are asking for the steady state, okay, you know? So and here we're simply saying the steady state does not exist. No, you get sort of some pulsing. And over here it does exist, and you can identify these phases in the mean field theory. That's right, we're calculating steady state. But I mean, we really have to do time-dependent dynamics, because to identify these unstable regimes and so on, this is really, we have to do. And we only know how to do it in mean field theory. So I really would like to know how to describe phase transitions like this by some, you know, other maybe more powerful many-body techniques. Sort of Keldysh could be a starting point for doing some of that, but Keldysh actually reduces in our case to master equation. And okay, we can talk about this maybe afterwards. Okay, so let me do now this last example, because I mean, I really like it, because when people hear these kind of stories, they always say, well, this is becoming, you know, particularly when we talk about Kitaev black hat, it's very esoteric, you know. So that's the point where you would like to convince your quantum optics experimentalists to do something, and I believe that many of these ideas can be done with optical lattices, but they are not there yet. So let me show you the example that we can do, and this is at the moment for the trapped ions. And so I want to explain it because the idea is to explain, you know, what has to be done. But really, we want to do it in 2D, and we want to do it with cold atoms because this is a scalable system. The ions are not. So there has been a whole story about Kitaev's story cold Hamiltonian because atomic physicists love it because this is sort of the benchmark of their engineering for the Hubbard Hamiltonians, and many people have contributed. In the dissipative context, I want to point out the paper we wrote with Hans-Peter Büchler together this year in Nature Physics. They talked about toric coat Hamiltonian, putting an auxiliary atom inside and using this atom with optical bumping to provide four particle dissipation for the rest to sort of what we call stabilizer cooling. And the stabilizer cooling is what I will explain afterwards, but we will map these plaquettes to an ion string, which is of course non-scalable, but it sort of will tell you the ideas. And now, you know, in this context, we've talked about ground state cooling, and there was a similar paper again from Garching about these things, but they've sort of used an auxiliary atom to hop around in some form. Okay, so this is the vision. Okay, that's what we want to do. So we are, you know, at the moment doing something very simple, which is we take a single plaquette over here, and let me write now down four stabilizer operators. You know, all of us know that in Kitaev's cold Hamiltonian, they have these plaquettes, and we have these cross terms and the star terms with XXX and Y and the ZZZ and so on. If I reduce this problem down to a single plaquette, okay, I have now here written four stabilized operators. You can see that one is a four-particle operator, and the point is that all of these operators here commute, and they have a common eigenstate, and turns out this is a GHD state. So the question is now this: can I do sort of an optical bumping that I pump the system from an arbitrary initial state of my four qubits that I have over here, sitting on my lattice, into a state, you know, that at the end will be a GHD state by engineering the corresponding Krauss maps? So the question is how to engineer Krauss maps. Before I talk about phonons, but now I talk about photons, spontaneous emission. And as I said, we map the system now. This is sort of the poor guy's approximation, something which is now a linear ion chain. We declare this to be environment. This is undergoing optical bumping, and then we want to engineer now master equations that implement this kind of stabilizer pumping that we have over there. So this is cooling to the ground state. In this most simple case, we shouldn't call it Kitaev model because this is too simple here. Okay, so instead of telling you the four-particle case, I will go now with you to a case that we can really write down very simply, which is the analogous Bell state. Okay, so let me talk about two, and then if you believe me that we can also do it for four, and then I'll show the results. So if I take Bell states, you know, of two ions, and for example, I can ask the question, can I do pumping, optical pumping, in a many-body sense, in the sense of this Krauss map engineering or master equation engineering, so that one of these Bell states, you know, that we have over here, that we can actually do that. What's the time actually now?
5 minutes.
Okay, I think I'll copy that. Okay, so now you pick one of these Bell states, and then you ask yourself, can we write down the Krauss map where we engineer a dissipative dynamics where a general initial state sort of, you know, contracts and at the very end becomes the desired state? This is this entanglement engineering that we want to do. But of course, we want to engineer the Krauss maps via engineering, you know, with this auxiliary ion, with our sort of extended master equation and all of these toolbox of gates that we have, these dynamics. So let me explain this, how this works in the case of the Bell state. This is sort of like the most simple tutorial that one can give here that illustrates this fact. Now, we have in our case, of course, a master equation here. You know, we want to engineer a master equation. So let's declare one state, like this one over here, to be the target state. And of course, there would be the other three Bell states over here. Initially, you might be, you know, this is our desired state, but at the very beginning, you have a completely mixed state of all of these things. So let's now do optical bumping where we push everything into this corner, which at the end, hopefully, is the pure state over here. So let's first of all look at the jump operator over here. And this is somewhat quite obvious what this jump operator does, because this is a projection operator. You know, this is one of the stabilizers here. That's eigenvalues plus and minus one. And what this thing does, it is a projection operator here that, you know, if you're in the wrong state, then this thing acts something and then actually flips a spin. And let's look at what these actions now is in terms of these block states over here. So let's apply C1, first of all, to the state C pi plus. If you do a little bit of exercises, you know, go all the way down here. At the end, you find zero. Indeed, the desired Bell state is a dark state of our jump operator. So at the end, it makes sense to try to engineer it. So psi plus is a dark state of the jump operator and therefore left invariant. So when we apply this time evolution, we will sort of, you know, throw up everything else, but this particular part will be isolated. We will not touch it without dissipation. In a similar way, one finds, for example, that C1 acting now, the other Bell state will be psi plus, and then you can also do also the other one. So what we have done over here is this, essentially, that we are sort of pumping in these four particle Bell states, you know, into this upper line that we're indicating here. And the second jump operator we can also consider. Now you can see that we have an XX over here. That's another stabilizer operator. And it turns out that the effect of the second jump operator is that it takes the part from this thing over here. So if you combine both of them here together, you know, you get, of course, that you pump everything over there. So the question is, how do we engineer such kind of jump operators here? You can see that this is highly non-trivial because this is actually a three-spin interaction. So we need a three-spin interaction with the reservoir. But it is exactly this point, I mean, how there are all of these gates that we have in ion traps become available. And that's, of course, also true when we take optical lattices and then we have our tools of either putting in interactions that are sort of many particle interactions that many of us have talked about. But here we do it just with gates. So let me now introduce, as I said before, an auxiliary ion, and this is the one undergoing spontaneous emission. So this is initially prepared in some state, and this thing will be, you know, whatever you have. This can be a mixed state if you want to then do this optical bumping. So we have certain tools available in the context of these ions. In this case, there's an entangling operation. Mühlmann and Sørensen wrote this down. It's a very effective gate in the experiment because Rainer Blatt can do these things for five ions at the end with a fidelity of something like, I think it's now 86 or 87%. So this is just really remarkable. So these are very high fidelity gates operating at the same time on many ions. You can do the two ion gate with a fidelity of 99.3%. And so what does this thing mean? If I apply this kind of Mühlmann-Sørensen gate without going into details, you know, essentially what it would mean is this, that you have the auxiliary states here, and then you got your four Bell states. What the Mühlmann-Sørensen gate does, it's sort of putting a marker, namely, you know, if you are in this part of the Hilbert space, the psi plus or minus, you know, leaves it and so on, but here you sort of, you know, copying this fact, sort of like asking for the parity of this thing is copied into the state one. And the two-qubit gate, which is then added afterwards, you know, acts on these two, and what it does, it makes this spin flip that I talked about before. After acting, you know, finding out this parity of the state, you have to flip a spin. So this is just a normal two-qubit gate that you do over here. So what this does is, you know, it's essentially the mapping which is indicated over here. And then number three, you go in and now you do optical bumping of the ion where you erase the information, the ion, by sort of pumping these things back to zero. So by optical bumping and coupling to the vacuum mode, so the radiation field as a reservoir, you map 0 to 0 and 1 to 1. This is the part where you trace over this environment, and in this optical bumping, then you get your Krauss maps out. So actually, if you do these things, if you take an initial state, this is the experiment. No, in this case, they always got here the psi plus. No, start out with whatever. You can also take a mixed state. So taking these steps, you know, gives you the desired entangled state, and if you do these things on the lattice, and they can do this with these fidelities that are indicated over here. Now, actually, the more interesting case is the one of these so-called stabilizer pumping, because now we have to do these four-particle, you know, quantum jump operators, or even five-particle quantum jump operators. And all of these things have to be engineered by some gates or some kind of interactions, if you're on a lattice. And as I said, the eigenstate of all of that would be just a GHC state. But now you do the complete tomography at the very beginning, and you prepare a completely mixed state of these four qubits. Start out over here. And then you start to apply your Krauss maps, you know, C1, C2. And you can see that you're sort of successively cleaning up these things until the very end you got your GHC state. It's not the one with the highest fidelity. Actually, direct engineering probably would even be more efficient, but it demonstrates how we do pumping, you know, in this many particle space. And if you consider this to be sort of the most minimal instance of something like this Kitaev plaquette cooling, then in that sense, this would sort of, you know, demonstrate some of these ideas. Okay, so I find this remarkable, but I do believe that many of these ideas are possible in the case of optical lattices. being able to go to 2D and having a scalable system, which at the moment with the ion is not possible. But at least this demonstrates that these ideas have some experimental relevance. They also are able to do, actually, by the way, four-body interactions. So if you want to do a time step, you know, and the four-body interaction, they have done these things also with these kind of gates. And this works quite well with some high fidelity. This was this experimental group. And of course, Rainer Blatt is the one who owns this experiment. And here's all of these, you know, clever people. Markus Müller was the theory and a student in our group working on this. And Julio Barrero was the one who actually was responsible for the experiment here. Okay, I have here another thing. Do I have 1 minute left, or? I have 1 minute. Okay, good.
2 minutes.
Okay, even 2 minutes, so I can do five slides. Okay, I just want to sort of, as the last thing, throw in something that we are working on at the moment and sort of like a kind of a discussion point here. You know, at the moment, we are looking at a completely dissipative system in the following sense. We are looking at bilayer systems of, for example, that we want to use, for example, sort of a cold plate of atoms. And imagine that you got the BC over here, or these are atoms, like rubidium atoms. And you do, or you're doing, for example, laser cooling of rubidium atoms. But you want to develop something like a cold plate for a second class of particles that maybe live on a different layer. And we know now, of course, with optical lattices, we know how to do bilayer systems. So these can be polar molecules, but it can be anything else, maybe that cannot be cooled directly. There's no laser cooling, for example, for at least normal polar molecules, because there's no cycling transitions. So the kind of dissipative engineering that we're doing here is quite different from what I talked about before. We want to argue now as follows. Well, all of us know how to do laser cooling, or we even got BEC, so we know how to laser cool atoms. And if you laser cool atoms, then it simply means that, hello, if you have an atom and you're sort of, you know, cycling here, this is Doppler, you can also do polarization gradient cooling. But we need a means for these atoms that get very cold, because then the BEC by laser cooling to dock to the second layer. And the way that we do that is this, that we can, of course, make sort of artificial polar molecule out of these atoms over here, because let me take a Rydberg state up here, and let me assume for the moment that I got a large electric field. It's easy to make here dipole moments in the Rydberg state that are kilodipole, but we just want to mix a little bit of this huge dipole moment here to the ground state. So this means that we got now atoms, and I'm not sure I know how to start now here this. It's running. It's a simulation, you know, of atoms that are now, for example, undergoing laser cooling. And you can see they very nicely crystallize. And once they crystallize down here, I mean, it's a very classical phase. I apologize for that here, this conference. You can see that there's interesting dynamics, like these things sort of, you know, cool down on the atomic sides forming crystals. You can see there's something quite cute going on here. There's these jumps in energy. And what's actually going on here is the following thing. That once in a while, you know, even though we are off-resonant over here, a jump happens where you populate a highly excited state, and then it has a huge dipole moment. And if it has a huge dipole moment, the consequence is this, that this atom over here that underwent this rare event has all of a sudden a huge dipole moment and is kind of ejected. You can see this particle flying out here. You know? So these are rare events that are sort of rare explosions. So we have to deal with rare explosions in our system. Here. And if you look at the sympathetic cooling bilayer of the molecules, you know, in the next layer, you can ask, how fast can you cool? And our argument at the moment, I don't give any numbers here, is this, that we can sort of see that we are quite optimistic that we can actually get significant cooling on the lower layer. And this would be kind of a, you know, dissipative cold plate where atoms are cold or do the cooling, but you dock via long-range interactions to another reservoir. This is a classic example. The rest of the talk was quantum. Okay, so let me summarize them here. That's what we had at the beginning, you know. So I talked first about the bad part, which is the coherence and heating in lattices. And I believe that there's a lot of interesting physics to be done in very close collaboration with experiments. You know, they get these things for free, so it might be easy to convince an experimentalist to work on these things. You can even introduce artificial heating. It would be very interesting to test this interplay between many body physics and decoherence or dissipation given by spontaneous emission. And at the very end, this will be one of the fundamental limits, you know, that limit all of these kind of optical lattice physics. So to understand that, I think it's very fundamental and basic. And extending these things for fermions, I think, will be very interesting. Well, then we had these parts down here. There, okay, we know how to do DMRG in 1D. Andrew Daly is our expert who is running all of these quantum trajectory things. At least for the master equation, this is valid. We can do relatively large systems because that's only 1D. And it's only a master equation, of course, but master equation is relevant, as I explained. And then I believe that really these exciting things here of doing engineering dissipation in the more general context by seeing this interplay and talking about non-equilibrium many-body dynamics and sort of phase diagrams that this is interesting, and of course, that quantum information is sort of another part of the whole story, like this idea of deceptive quantum computing. And with this, I would like to stop.
Thank you, Peter. I guess we might have more questions.
So there's a question about your just a bit of preparation of a BEC. So in one dimension, normally you'd have only an algebraic superfluid. But in this case, do you have true long?
Actually, what we get out on this level for the BC is, in terms of the many-body physics, kind of trivial because you have a Bloch band, you have non-interacting particles, you put everything into the lowest band, into the lowest point, and this is what we get here. We engineer the reservoir to do that. And the interesting part is, of course, the interplay with the interaction, how do the interactions. And of course, we've done here a mean field theory. So in principle, this is in infinite dimensions, I guess, what we're doing here, this phase diagram. We were not able to do corresponding DMRG calculations for these kind of things. So, I would be very interested in learning many-body techniques for solving these master equations, but really on a many-body level. One way of doing that would be to, you can master equation, you can rewrite it as Keldysh. Keldysh is really very similar. If you make certain Markov approximations in Keldysh, it is a master equation. So maybe on this context, some of the many-body techniques, that are available, are maybe much more, powerful or already available to do some of these things here. But I'm not an expert in this part.
Okay, thank you.
So it's also a question to the kind of bad part, the first one. So you mentioned that the blue and red detunings are not equivalent in terms of heating.
Heating means what? If I calculate this energy transfer for single particles and even, just what the initial slope is, then it turns out to be the same. But this is not the relevant quantity because in an experiment, what you do is this, that you excite atoms in the excited state. And when you talk about heating, it is a non-equilibrium heating that these things do not thermalize. When I got an atom in the first band, it will never decay back down to the lower band, giving the other ones more energy. This is essentially prohibited, like all of these Davalon excitations and the repulsively bound pairs. So the time scales do not work out for these things to thermalize, and therefore to talk about heating only in terms of energy is an oversimplification, which is simply not true or appropriate in this case.
And then blue lattice is better than red?
Yes. But in the blue lattice, of course, you might have problems with collisions, because in the blue lattice, you always, in this molecular branch, in the upper one, you always get a point, the quantum point, and so you might sort of run for the other one. But it would be very interesting experimentally to see this thing. So I see that Trey is saying, yes, okay, great. So we want people like you to try that.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
Okay.
Next question.